I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Suburban women, once reliably Republican, played a key role in 2018, part of the blue wave that gave the Democrats control of the House of Representatives. And it looks like they are playing an even bigger role in the 2020 presidential race. In recent weeks, President Trump has been begging for their votes at rallies in Pennsylvania and in other states. Here's a montage.
The Democrats in D.C. have been and want to, at a much higher level, abolish our beautiful and successful suburbs. Your home will go down in value and crime rates will rapidly rise. Suburbia will be no longer as we know it.
You know what else? I'm also getting your husbands. They want to get back to work, right? They want to get back to work. We're getting your husbands back to work and everybody wants it.
Suburban women, will you please like me?
Remember?
Please. I saved your damn neighborhood, okay? We saved suburbia in the U.S.
Currently, former Vice President Biden is winning over suburban women largely because of the administration's mishandling of the COVID crisis that has turned women's worlds upside down. But the suburbs are not monolithic, and they are not Trump's Leave It to Beaver housewife fantasy world either. On today's final episode of our monthly series, Battleground 2020, how the presidential race is playing among women in the Pennsylvania suburbs. And joining us is Lara Putnam. She's chair of the History Department at the University of Pittsburgh, also research chair for the Center for International Studies. And Lara Putnam, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be joining you.
Just jumping off that montage of the message and the vision that President Trump was sending about the suburbs to women living in the suburbs, how do you think that resonated with suburban women in Pennsylvania?
With actually existing suburban women, I think, you know, the image that he was has been trying to present of the suburbs as a space where men, you know, earn salaries and women need to be protected from outside influences probably doesn't resonate with most women in Pennsylvania who think of themselves as living in suburbs today. Those are emotional touch points that would have been maybe more effective a generation ago. But the reality is that Pennsylvania suburbs are more diverse. They're home to many, many two-earner households, and they've also been the epicenter of anti-Trump organizing for the past now nearly 4 years. So we shouldn't be surprised that the Pennsylvania suburbs are not necessarily following Donald Trump's lead on how they should be seeing him.
Well, as we know, the suburbs are not monolithic. But again, sort of broadly speaking, I guess you can look at the suburbs that ring a city like Philadelphia or ring a city like Pittsburgh where you are. But there are other suburbs that are in more rural parts of the state. Help us understand those suburbs. And I think they're a little more complicated, if I can put it that way, than the ring around Philadelphia, for instance.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all suburbs are complicated in their own ways, right? But
sure.
A good way of thinking about it is to notice that the suburbs around urban cores that have continued to be dynamic generators of jobs over the past 20, 25 years have really been remade by the kinds of population movement that those dynamic economies have attracted. So those suburbs tend to have folks with college degrees or advanced degrees. They tend to be pretty cosmopolitan. There are international immigrants there. There are people who've moved in from out of state, from other parts of the country. They're less white. They're more highly educated. They're more diverse along multiple dimensions, including ideologically. And that meant that those and they're also, I should say, you know, centers of lots of women who have made important careers for themselves. So those are those sort of more upscale suburbs around more fortunate cities have been, as we've been saying, sort of the epicenter of reaction against Donald Trump from day one of his election, really.
And just jump in here. So they're more liberal, more leaning, more solidly Democratic.
Well, they are now, but what's so striking is that these aren't necessarily places that were liberal in November 2016. They're places whose politics had long been sort of purple, slowly, they had been like the country club Republican suburbs. They, as they diversified, had newer people coming in. They were trending somewhat, and as the Republican Party, moved towards a more nativist position, those suburbs had been maybe trending blue. Some of them, what we think of as like the Romney Clinton counties of this country, places that had voted maybe narrowly for Mitt Romney, but then swung for Hillary Clinton. But in terms of their overall politics, lots of these places had been pretty apolitical and also had almost uniformly Republican elected officials from school boards to county councils to, township boards and more. And it wasn't actually until after Donald Trump was elected when a sort of new wave of women became hyper-mobilized and sort of woke up the next morning and said, what happened? How is this my country? This isn't the world that I thought that I wanted to raise my children or my grandchildren in. And looked around locally as well and began noticing how many spaces for political action they had been ignoring. And they hadn't been involved in. And that's why we've seen, for instance, in the Philly collar counties, places like Chester County, which really hadn't been some kind of liberal bastion, quite the contrary. Chester County hadn't elected a Democratic county council, I think, since the Civil War, and they've done so in recent years because there's been such intense organized, mobilizing candidate recruitment and so on. So there's been a sort of critical mass of women who sort of stepped into politics on the center-left in these more upscale suburbs. And they flipped a lot of seats because there were a lot of seats available to flip because there were a lot of Republican incumbents at every level of the ballot in such places.
And would you say that President Trump was the catalyst for this?
Absolutely. 100%. He was the catalyst, but he hasn't been the only target. And that's, I think, one thing that, national political reporters, when they look at a place like Pennsylvania, all they are talking about tends to be Biden and Trump. And I think what they're missing out on is what a pervasive, much broader political shift has happened as the state house is also being remade and, county level offices, district attorney positions and so on are all also being remade by these women's new engagement in politics.
I'd ask you about these more rural suburbs, and let's look at that by way of comparison, because I think there's some interesting similarities and some interesting differences.
Yeah, absolutely. So the cities that haven't been as dynamic and able to generate ongoing jobs as Philadelphia, as Pittsburgh, didn't create the kinds of suburbs that drew in new people at the same rate, right? So what we have so there are suburbs, Allentown has suburbs, Reading has suburbs, Beaver, there are suburbs in depressed one-time, areas that had been industrial powerhouses and really haven't maintained that position. So those areas, those subdivisions, which tend to be, less dense, in part because they haven't gotten filled in by newcomers, because these are in regions that haven't been drawing such population so strongly. So those suburbs are less dense, less highly educated, less diverse, less international. And they're in regions where, in contrast to what I was just describing to you, the sort of existing political establishment had been Democratic until pretty recently. So these aren't the, country club Republican picture. These are places where there had been, a generation ago, there was a really strong countywide Democratic machine in Luzerne or Lackawanna or Beaver, Washington counties. And so in these places, politics is complicated right now because on the one hand, you have a population which is older, made up of many more people who have may not have college degrees, people who have been frustrated by the long-term decline in U.S. manufacturing power, people who Donald Trump very intentionally spoke to and found a lot of resonance in the views, especially of older men, but also women in some of these regions. So you have in western Pennsylvania and in northeast Pennsylvania, on the one hand, some broad regions where the trend of pulling politics actually in the direction of Republicans, where you have, where these sort of old-school Democratic political machines have been sort of slowly declining, and now they've finished sort of collapsing in recent years. But you also, in those spaces, do have not quite at the as large scale or pervasive as in the Philly collar counties, but you do have areas where there are smaller communities that are more highly educated, have diverse and liberal-minded middle-aged and retired-age women who are doing the same kind of organizing work that we were describing as happening in the Philly collar counties and so on.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions.
At a smaller scale.
Sure. Yeah. And I think, it's interesting to compare and contrast, but as you were describing some of these more rural suburban counties who are, as you say, struggling economically, do have less education, and have dealt with some of these issues of their sort of changing dynamics, that does sound a bit like Trump's base. Can we say that if we're looking at suburban women in more rural parts of PA, is that Trump's base, or are they starting to peel off?
So the big picture is that there was strong support for Donald Trump in what I think of as the subdivisions. So it's like these less dense, more outer suburbs of in the industrial areas.
Right.
But for sure, those areas were strong centers of support for Donald Trump in 2016. Even then, men in those regions were more supportive of Donald Trump than women in those regions. And since then, women in those regions have, although the majority have maintained their support for Donald Trump, some still feel very strongly supportive of him, others have pulled away. And actually, what we've seen in particular is that although college-educated women statewide, there as elsewhere, had not been very supportive of Donald Trump from the beginning, that trend has accelerated. So, women with college degrees are at this point a huge gap in their presidential preference. But also women who may have, some college or no college degrees increasingly are also stepping away from support for the president, although in some cases they may still their vote may be narrowly balanced. But that's a real change from the strong preference support that Trump got against Hillary Clinton in 2016.
Well, let's take a very short break. I do want to pick up on several things that you said there. That's Laura Putnam, and she's chair of the history department at the University of Pittsburgh, also research chair for the Center for International Studies. And it's Battleground 2020, probably our final Battleground 2020. We began this in January, looking at parts of Pennsylvania as a battleground state and the various roles that it has played and some of the shifts in political ideology. We are talking about women in the suburbs, and we want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499, especially if you're a suburban woman. Woman, we want to hear from you.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone. Will Pennsylvania be where the 2020 presidential election is won or lost this year, as it was in 2016? In today's final installment of Radio Times Battleground 2020 series, we're looking at the critical role that Pennsylvania's women are playing this year, especially in the suburbs. We'll be talking in just a couple of minutes about some key swing counties in Northeast and Western PA that could decide the winner. Again, to join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And Lara Putnam is our guest. She's chair of the history department at the University of Pittsburgh. I was looking at 538, and they looked at white suburban women, and they found that support for Biden was 54%, support for Trump was 41%. When they looked at white suburban men, it was almost reversed. 57% for Trump, 41% for Biden. So it sounds, Laura Putnam, the way you're describing suburban women, that there are disagreements within families about these two candidates, between partners, between husbands and wives, in households. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. The pattern you're describing is real, and it's been intensifying, we think, from the data that we have since the onset of the coronavirus pandemic. So it's always been the case that it's been the case for the last decade or so that women vote to the left of men, but that gap has been strongest across single men and single women, whereas married men and married women's votes have tended to sort of converge. Both, like within individual households, you can see that convergence over time. People listen to each other and shift their views. And it also happens sort of demographically. We see that after women marry, their political views take sort of two steps to the right. And after men marry, in general terms, their political views take like one step to the left.
That's
interesting. Yeah, exactly. So it's like a slightly, there's some learning on both sides, but it has tended to be with women upon marrying moving closer to their husband's views, although with movement on both sides. But what looks to be happening since the coronavirus pandemic is that, in a sense, married women's views are sort of converging outward towards single women's views, right? So that they're separating away from married men's views and pulling away. And it makes sense that, married men and married women or in households with children, coronavirus pandemic and its restrictions are hitting everyone, but they're especially hitting women's lives, right? The fact that in our society, it's still the case that women are often the primary caregivers or organizers of care for their own children, for their parents, sometimes for their grandchildren, more so than men, even though, of course, norms have changed somewhat with this. But that's still the basic pattern. There's a lot of informal caring labor and sort of the organizing of and coordinating of household work and concern for family members is done by women. And the coronavirus pandemic has just upended that. The restrictions, the school closures, we saw one of the largest sudden drops that we've seen in married women in the labor force participation by women with children this past September, when what should have been school starting suddenly didn't mean that kids were out of the house and under someone else's supervision. So women's lives have really been upended, and it makes sense that women are not dismissing the coronavirus in the same way that within some communities and men are more able to.
Well, I mean, we're all living the coronavirus, but as you describe it, it seems like the experience is even more intense for a lot of women. Here's a comment from Luann. What I don't hear referenced is the fact that we middle-aged suburban women experienced second wave feminism as a big force in our lives. Since then, we've been out in the suburbs living our lives, and what's going on now has reawakened our sense of activism and feminism. And I think you kind of referenced this earlier, Laura Putnam, in the sort of sense of awakening, we're focusing on suburban women, I think is happening beyond the suburbs, but the sense of awakening among women in the suburbs.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, your listener really, captures something which is such a broadly shared experience, which is that of women who, became awakened and intentionally sort of feminist, and then poured a lot of effort of the energy that created into building careers and having an impact within their community and within their workplaces and within their families. And in some ways, Donald Trump's election was seen by them as like there's this other space that where I thought that, women were doing okay and like someone else was battling the forces of misogyny. And it turns out that actually even in this political realm, or maybe especially in this political realm, the same kind of misogyny, dismissal of women, the same stuff I've been, pushing back against in my workplace all these years, suddenly this guy's elected president. So that's what we hear again and again in interviews, is people drawing those lines or connecting the dots between their own their personal, efforts and the work that they've done in their own lives and their own workplaces, and saying, okay, now I'm going to take these skills that I've built, and I'm going to put them into a new realm. I'm going to push them into changing politics because I thought someone else had this, and I realized that they don't. We've got to do it ourselves.
Laura, I'm curious about how you see the protests, but even beyond the protests, some of the unrest in cities. Philadelphia this week has had a series of protests and some unrest, some looting, frankly, as a result of the killing of a young man in West Philadelphia. We heard the president in our montage talking about, you know, the suburbs being under siege and essentially referencing, you know, those people who could be moving into the suburbs. I protected you from them. But how do you see these protests playing out among people living in the suburbs, especially women?
Yeah, it was quite striking with this summer as, you know, protests in support of racial justice, speaking out for Black Lives Matter and reacting first to the murder of George Floyd, spread across communities, across the state and across the country, including in big cities. And those are the protests in big cities are the ones that sort of made the nightly news and the ones where it was easiest for, you know, hot-headed people or bad actors to, or, you know, police escalation to push things into violence or broken windows or something being set on fire. Now, the reality is that, you know, scholars who've studied this have actually recently published the most recent tally suggests that 96% of Black Lives Matter protests were entirely nonviolent and with, you know, no actions of any kind of property damage or others. And in the remaining 4%, in most cases, the violence was enacted towards protesters rather than by protesters. But of course, that's not what's been on some of our news stations, right? If it bleeds, it leads. If it's something, if there's a car set on fire, that's what's going to be standing in for, you know, a whole protest movement, which didn't actually in its entirety look like that at all. And so it's clear that, you know, Donald Trump from the beginning has, you know, really sort of doubled down on the bet that he would be able to convince suburban women that they were at risk from what he described as, you know, violence being generated by protests in cities. But what we've seen in polling and elsewhere is that he's just not trusted. That message is not trusted. And so that rather than seeing, you know, the suburban women leaning into his rhetoric and leaning into sort of coinciding with that framing that he's offering, you know, suburban women, I saved your suburbs. They're not buying it. And that's when we hear, you know, women responding to interviews or pollsters and saying the president is so divisive. The president is, you know, his rhetoric is tearing us apart. What you're hearing is the voice of people who've been offered a different perspective on what's happening, right? They're not just hearing his views or that media framing. And I think that's a result of we'll circle back to where we started, the sort of local political building and local infrastructure building that's happened in so many places, in the suburbs especially,
sure,
has meant that women aren't only hearing about what's happening in Black Lives Matter protests, either through the president's tweets or through, you know, Fox News or whatever. They're hearing about it from neighbors. They're hearing about it from politically engaged friends around them. They're hearing about it from local high school students who organized sympathy protests. And as I said, there were over 230 different communities in Pennsylvania actually saw locally organized Black Lives Matter protests. So the suburbs are not spectators in this issue. They're not, you know, distant, scared spectators to the drama of thinking seriously about racial justice and policing. Folks have stepped forward within Pennsylvania suburbs as elsewhere to be part of that conversation in you know, beginning steps that are going to be meaningful.
Well, you know what, Laura, we could go on, but we got to leave it there. I've got two guests who are just chomping at the bit to join us.
Yep.
I appreciate you joining us on Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Wonderful talking.
And nice talking to you as well. Again, that was Laura Putnam, chair of the History Department at the University of Pittsburgh. Well, it is the final installment of Radio Times series Battleground 2020, our almost year-long look at the role that Pennsylvania is playing in this year's presidential race. We should have a pretty good idea this time next week about who the winner is. As things stand now in the Commonwealth, Biden is ahead of Trump. But Trump, going back to 2016, Trump was trailing Clinton a week before the 2016 election. Will history repeat itself? While Philadelphia and Pittsburgh are reliably Democratic strongholds, the fight now is over voters in more rural counties with residents who have voted for Democrats and for Republicans in past elections. In fact, a few Pennsylvania counties that voted for Obama twice voted for Trump 4 years ago. A lot has changed since then. We are asking or joined now by Chris Borick. He's a professor of political science, director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion. That is in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Chris Borick, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, it's great to be back, Marty.
And also with us is Joseph Morris. He's director of Mercyhurst Center for Applied Politics at Mercyhurst University, which is in Erie. And Joseph Morris, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And that's my phone ringing. No one is going to answer it. We will carry on. Chris Borick, let me begin with you. As more states come into play, and I'm thinking of Florida, I'm thinking of Texas, is Pennsylvania still a battleground state?
Oh, of course, Marty. It's still a battleground and perhaps the premier battleground. I think you can make the case that Florida always holds that position. It's got more electoral votes. It's always close. And of course, I think on election night, if we see that break towards Joe Biden, it might signal some things that the other states, including Pennsylvania, are a little bit less important. But I still have to rate Pennsylvania. And maybe it's a bias being a Pennsylvanian and someone that studies the state as likely the key or one of the key states in this election.
To you, Joseph Morris, I mean, what sets Pennsylvania apart from a lot of other states is that the voting of ballots will not start until November 3rd. And there's something like 7 or 8 counties that are not even going to start counting ballots until November 4th, the day after Election Day. How does that affect, I guess, the role that Pennsylvania could play this year?
Well, I think no matter how you look at it, Pennsylvania is going to be an absolutely critical state in this election. Joe Biden's path to victory is fairly broad in the sense that there are lots of roads that get him to 270 electoral college votes. But Donald Trump's path to victory is much narrower. I'm actually paying quite a bit of attention to the state of North Carolina, which, as many people might be aware, it has a race that is incredibly close between Biden and Trump. But it has an advantage over Pennsylvania, and that is it began processing ballots weeks ago, and it already has begun counting mail-in ballots. So I think what we learn from North Carolina will be really insightful. Namely, it'll tell us whether or not the polls are accurate at a much earlier date than Pennsylvania. And it'll also give us a sense of which way those mail-in ballots are carrying the election. Are they, in fact, as Democratic as we expect them to be?
Let me go back to you, Chris. There have been long lines in Philadelphia and in other parts of Pennsylvania. But I was reading that something like two-thirds of the voters in Pennsylvania are planning on voting in person. First of all, do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right. In fact, our polls have shown that, and a poll will be coming out with tomorrow shows exactly that. About two-thirds say they're going to vote in person. About a third, obviously, say they're going to or have voted by mail or in early voting, dropping off ballots. And that seems to align with the records that are coming out of the state in terms of, you know, ballots requested, ballots returned at this point. We're going to see exceptional turnout, Marty. It will significantly exceed what we saw in 2016. It will significantly exceed, you know, most elections that we've experienced in our lifetime in the state. And that to me is going to be a defining feature of how Pennsylvania ultimately turns out this cycle.
Are they turning out because they want to elect President Trump? They want to elect Vice President Biden? They hate Trump. They hate Biden. I mean, what is generating all this enthusiasm and interest, Chris?
I'll be a weasel and say yes to all those.
Yes, all of those things.
All of those. It really is. And for different levels, right? We see the enthusiasm for the president in our polls. His voters are much more enthusiastic about supporting President Trump than Joe Biden's supporters are supporting him. However, when we look at what Biden supporters feel about the race, they're just as energized or more about voting. They may not be in love with Joe Biden in the way that Trump voters are in love with Donald Trump, but they certainly are energized. And a lot of that energy emerges from their views on President Trump and their experience. And so lots of things are driving individuals to the ballot. And there'll be a significant, and I think this is a group that really, if there's the one kind of big uncertainty that I still have, it's those voters that weren't there in 2016. Mm-hmm. That are showing up, and there are going to be significant some that have never voted before. And that brings some degrees of uncertainty into this race. Who are they? Both parties think they're going to do pretty well at bringing in these voters this time. How do they break? What is the final portion? I think we got a pretty good feel on where people from the last election are going to be, and that's largely where they were last time. It's very much a race that I think that the turnout increases will have a big impact on what eventually happens when the votes are counted.
Joseph, we're almost up on a break here, but I mean, Biden has kind of held on to his, I shouldn't say kind of, has held on to his lead in Pennsylvania. Do you see that as solid for him? I hear from a lot of Democrats, they have a kind of PTSD from 2016, thinking Clinton had it not in the bag, but that she was ahead. But then, of course, on election night, things changed.
Yeah, and I think that's just a common sentiment. I have to say that I'm a little bit jealous that Chris is polling this year. We're unable to because of COVID. Our lab is shut down, so we're kind of in the dark here in Western Pennsylvania. But having said that, I think there's good reason to be concerned. I mean, if we look back to 2016, we know that pollsters made a number of errors. Most important, I think, or most influential was assuming that the electorate would look something like it ended up not looking. We overestimated turnout among certain people. So I think there's always that fear there, but I trust that my colleagues that are still able to do polling this semester are taking into account that error from last time.
Well, that's very generous of you. We have to take a very short break, much more after this break, including some clips from Biden and Trump in Erie. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoing, talking with Joseph Morris. He's associate professor, chair of the Department of Political Science at Mercyhurst, founder and director of the Mercyhurst Center for Applied Politics. That is in Erie, Pennsylvania. And from Allentown, Pennsylvania, Chris Borick. He's a professor of political science and director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion. And we are probably finishing up our series that we began in January, Battleground 2020, looking at the role that Pennsylvania will play or is playing this presidential election season. And we are looking at some of the swing counties in northeastern and western PA that could decide the winner next week. Let me play two clips. This is President Trump. He's addressing voters in Erie at a rally earlier in October. Let's give it a listen.
Before the plague came in, I had it made. I wasn't coming to Erie. I mean, I have to be honest. There's no way I was coming. I didn't have to. I would have called you and said, hey, Erie, you know, if you have a chance, get out. But we had this thing won.
And this is Joe Biden addressing voters in Erie also earlier in October.
Folks, this is it. The election's here. The choice couldn't be more stark. The stakes couldn't be higher. So many Pennsylvanians are facing hard times right now. After my debate in Cleveland last week, I took a train, which I've ridden a lot, an Amtrak train, northeastern Ohio into Pittsburgh and Greensburg, Latrobe, and Johnstown. And I heard the same stories everywhere I've been hearing all around the country. You're trying your best, but it never feels like enough. You're not looking for a handout. You're just looking for a fair shot.
And Joseph Morris, a lot of focus on Erie, where you are this election season. Two very different messages, two very different tones that we heard from those two candidates. How did they resonate in Erie?
Yeah, you know, honestly, we're going to have to wait till election day, I think, to find out. But I can tell you that Donald Trump, as always, put on a wonderful show. He's draws an enormous crowd. People pay a great deal of attention. I mean, anytime you have the president in town, it's a big deal. Just about everything stops. So his rally, I think, was incredibly effective at firing up voters. Joe Biden's was very much a low-key event here, and I would guess that if you asked 10 voters in Erie County whether or not Joe Biden visited, only about half would remember that he did. So I think the difference between the two events couldn't be really more stark.
And can we say at Trump's event, people were not wearing masks, were not socially distancing? I mean, anytime you look at these campaign events, you see a lot of people not following CDC guidelines.
Yeah, that was, in fact, the case here in Erie. Whether or not that mattered to Trump supporters, or it turns out to matter to Trump supporters, I think is going to be I think the answer is no. I mean, the people who attended the event, the people who watched the event live on television here in Erie, were by and large Trump supporters, and they're already on board with them.
Chris, let me go back to you. In terms of 2020, who is President Trump's base in Pennsylvania, and who is former Vice President Biden's base in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, Marty, the base is remain fairly what they were. You know, the president's strength, if you look at polling and voting results, certainly indicate that white working class voters throughout the state remain a cornerstone of his base. He does well, better among men. He does better among people in their, you know, older than 50, but maybe not senior citizens, kind of in that gap. We could talk a little bit about seniors going down, where he still performs well, but maybe not as strong. So, you know, among older, whiter, working class individuals in Pennsylvania, the president remains very, very popular and strong. Vice President Biden's strength certainly is, you know, if we go look at gender, remains strong, as in your first segments today, among women in Pennsylvania and across the country. Higher educated individuals are increasingly, they already have, but are increasingly breaking towards Biden. And his strength is within communities of color in the state and also nationally, particularly among African-Americans. And this goes back to issues like turnout and who in those groups will turn out and how that will ultimately affect what happens in Pennsylvania and beyond.
Do we know, Chris, about young people, young voters, or maybe even first-time voters? Do we have a sense of where they stand on these two candidates?
Yeah, this is really a great group, and we always look at this group and think about their impact. They're overwhelmingly supportive of Joe Biden, according to almost all the polling that I've seen. You know, again, margins matter, but it's somewhere in that 2-to-1 range, or at least, you know, 60-40, and probably a little bit better than that among people under 30. One thing that we've perpetually said over time, I probably said this on this show dozens
probably,
of times,
you know, go ahead.
It's an unrealized, you know, potential in most races that the voting group does not turn out as in proportion to its size. That changed a little bit in 2018, in fact, significantly. Well, almost every age group went up. Every age group went up in 2018 compared to past midterms elections like 2014. The growth among younger voters relative to what they usually do was higher. And that could be one of those other stories that we're looking at this year, just how high that number comes and how it is relative to other groups. We'll see, again, like 2018, all groups, age groups go up in terms of their turnout. Which ones go up the most? And I think there's at least some optimism that among those younger voters we'll see a repeat, if you will, of 2018.
You mentioned seniors. Some seniors are reliably much more reliable voters, but also seniors have this increased risk for contracting COVID-19. Chris, just quickly, if you don't mind, is this going to be an issue in Pennsylvania? And we have a lot of seniors in this state.
Yeah, we do, Marty. It's one of the oldest states in the country, has a very large population of senior citizens. They, a majority voted for President Trump in 2016. And the polls show some softening of that support. You know, it's not a total sea change, but enough softening in the polls that it is worrisome to the Trump campaign. It's a group, as you noted, that almost always votes. They've had the access, you might say, in a pandemic. Well, this could be problematic in turnout, but of course, with mail ballots, it's allowed that access to be still there for a lot of voters concerned. And speaking of COVID, it is a top-tier issue for all voters, but even more so, even more salient among older voters. And they give the president terrible ratings on that. So when you try to look at why he might have seen erosion in that group, it's not all COVID related, but it's certainly a major part of the change that seems to be a significant problem for Trump to repeat in 2016.
Well, we are looking at how the presidential race is playing out in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. That's Chris Borg from Muhlenberg College. Also with us, Joseph Morris from Mercyhurst University, both of them in Pennsylvania. And we want to hear from you about where you stand on the issues, the candidates. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Joseph, let me go to you. You're in the more western part of the state, and I do want to talk about this issue of fracking. Trump is all for it. Biden has said he doesn't want increased fracking on federal lands. He does not oppose it on private lands. But I wonder, in Pennsylvania, how important an issue fracking is.
Well, fracking is an important issue in the sense that it's symbolic of a wide range of other issues, and in many ways symbolic or represents the ideological differences of the candidates.
Yeah.
Here in the corner, the northwestern corner of the state, we did years ago extensive work on public opinion polling on fracking. And we found that voters, again, tended to associate fracking with a candidate's ideology, and that alone fracking wasn't all that important of an issue. But again, it's a symbolic or representative of the candidate's overall ideology. In the northwestern corner of the state, Erie in particular has been a place that has just struggled economically for decades. And Donald Trump did a wonderful job in 2016 of communicating this message that he understood the plight of the people in Erie and made jobs and infrastructure kind of a core part of his message in this part of the state. And those two issues, more than anything else, I think really are important for voters in this region.
Did he deliver? I mean, that was candidate Trump in 2016, now President Trump in 2020. Did he deliver on the jobs that he promised?
Well, the perception here in Erie County is that he did. We began polling just Erie County voters just after Donald Trump was inaugurated, and we've done it every year, at least twice a year since the beginning of his administration. And what we've seen is that voters' perception of the economy here in Erie has never been more positive. In the decade that I've been polling Erie County residents, their perception of the economy has never been stronger. And that includes not only the availability of jobs, but also their own personal financial situation. So even if we haven't seen the promise change, for example, an increase in manufacturing jobs, the perception is that things are going really well here in Erie County.
That's so interesting. So are we talking perception and reality? Are we talking about two different things, or is perception reality?
Well, I think it's a combination. There definitely is reason to be very positive about Erie's economy. However, the jobs that Donald Trump promised Erie County voters simply haven't materialized. And those jobs are jobs that provide a good wage, allow people to work a 40-hour week, come home and focus on Little League or whatever they focus on the weekends. Those jobs have not yet arrived, and certainly that explosion in manufacturing jobs that the president promised back in 2016, that is definitely not materialized.
Chris, let me read a couple of comments and get a comment from you, one from Dan. He says, I find it amazing that Trump would tell voters in Erie that he would have ignored them if he wasn't desperate. It's like asking a girl to a prom and telling her you wouldn't ask her if the first three girls you asked hadn't turned you down. A lot has been made of what the president said to the residents of Erie. Perhaps, Joe, I could toss it back to you. I mean, it was sort of like, you know, I don't really need or even want to be here. Did that bother people of Erie?
Again, I was shocked when he said that. But I think what the voters here in Erie that are already supporting Trump heard is that, you know, he had this thing wrapped up. He knows that Erie loves him. And if it wasn't for this pandemic, there'd be no reason for him to be here because he already had a great relationship with the people of Erie. Of course, Democrats heard a very different message, the message that was talked a lot about in by the national media. So I don't know that that's going to matter a whole lot to people.
Chris, here are some comments I will read to you. One from Joe. I'm a young voter in Pennsylvania. I have a lot of friends in Pennsylvania. A lot of my friends are going for Biden. They're really enthusiastic about him and about voting for him. Clear, I was born and raised in upstate Pennsylvania. I don't know if your guest has it right. Trump isn't good at rallying people. He's good at rallying their racism. A question from Dylan. How big of a concern is the prospect of a slim enough margin in Pennsylvania that it becomes a legal battle? And is it a realistic concern that Pennsylvania votes could end up in the Supreme Court? And that is one of the concerns, Chris, just because of how things are in 2020, that, I mean, we're clearly, I doubt we're going to know the results on Election Day, maybe by the end of the week, but there are all sorts of potential lawsuits at play. What do you see?
You'd have to be very naive to think that the courts may not have a big role in the election in Pennsylvania. Now, of course, if it's a very large margin, the probability of having any kind of impactful change goes down. We have court cases almost every election season, and often they don't change the outcome. But you can imagine, as the listener suggests, a tighter race in Pennsylvania. I mean, the polls have been tight. Once again, I can't say that enough. You know, it's still a very competitive race. It seems Biden has a slight advantage, but you can imagine it being very close, and the courts asked to intervene in a whole number of ways. I'm coming up
including
to speed
recently
with just the number of ways that could happen, Marty. And so most definitely that is a potential part of this story. And as we started our conversation, Pennsylvania's pivotal role makes that all the more important. If it comes down to Pennsylvania being key as a keystone, once again, those court cases could be incredibly impactful, if not determinative.
Chris, we're almost out of time here, but you've been polling for some time now. Is 2020, is it harder to poll in 2020, or is it just more complicated, or how different is it?
It's much different over time. I've been polling for 25 years, 20 years in Pennsylvania. And it is. I mean, it's always challenging getting participants methodologically. There's lots of challenges. I think as a whole, Joe alluded to this before, there are some changes in the industry, including our poll that I've written about. We did not wait for educational attainment in 2016. It was never a kind of big divide up until it wasn't as big of a divide as it was in 2016. And after we've introduced that into our polls since, and I'm optimistic a lot of other pollsters have done that too, and it should be a positive for this cycle. Again, it's taking samples to make inferences about populations, and that's always challenging.
Sure. A snapshot in time, right?
Indeed.
Chris Borg, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. He's a professor of political science, director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion. Joseph Morris, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He joined us by Skype, and he's associate professor, chair of the Department of Political Science at Mercyhurst, which is in Erie, PA, founder and director of the Mercyhurst Center for Applied Politics. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.